So we're now on to the second panel of the day with two speakers, David Williams from the City and Hal Dent from the Bristol Community. So what we'll do again is you both have up to 40 minutes each to speak, and then we'll open the floor to hopefully another lively round of questions. I don't know if either of you want to admit being realists, but that would help. So we'll start with David first.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sophie, for inviting me. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I also just want to mention thanks to Mira for organising a panel at BISA in the spring, where this paper, or at least bits of it, were first presented. I hope the paper hasn't changed a huge amount in its written form, but I've been thinking about it on since then, and I hope, for those of you who are there, that I will make slightly more sense of what I'm trying to say this time around. Firstly, just to put it in some context, the paper really spills out as a long-standing worry I've had about IR theory since I first started seriously thinking about it when I finished my PhD. And this is really the problem about whether or not and under what conditions states can sensibly be said to act. I'll talk a bit more about what the problem is in a moment. In some senses, it's a bit of a sort of sideline, but on the other hand, it's also shaped, as I hope to make sure at the end, by a fairly kind of long-standing set of investigations into the role of external agents in Africa, and particularly the kind of policies, the views, as it were, the pictures of the state and its possibilities that African external agencies have. And it's also inspired, at least in part, although I won't say very much about this empirically, by a thought that what I'll be calling the politics of agency is particularly acute in the contemporary African context. It may have been acute in the African context for long, not much longer than that. It's evidenced most recently, of course, by Libya, but also Cote d'Ivoire, Zimbabwe, and if we go back even further, we can think of a host of other countries where the question about who, under what conditions, a state may sensibly be said to be acting is a very real one. I want to make what I hope are a number of related points about the problem of state agency. The problem of whether or not states, as states, can sensibly be said to act is a problem, I think, in IR theory. It's been more or less recognized by at least some IR theorists. It's also a problem of philosophy. There's extensive literature on the philosophy of corporate agency and its possibilities, but I won't talk about that today. But also, and perhaps most importantly, it's a practical political problem. A problem, in other words, for the conduct of everyday international politics. It seems to me that everyday international politics simply can't get off the ground unless you have at least some understanding, some concept, some thing like state agency. What I want to argue, so let me just briefly say what kind of main points are before saying, talking about some of them in more detail. Underlying the paper is the thought that the problem of state agency is not one to be resolved through theory or philosophy. There are lots of arguments in IR theory, Alexander Wentz, famously, there are lots of others, and there are lots of arguments in philosophy too. But I'm not sure that that's the best way to go, or at least it doesn't seem to be the only interesting thing to be said about it. Rather, it seems to me we might be better off treating the problem of state agency as a political problem, a problem, in other words, politics, to be investigated empirically rather than theoretically or philosophically. In other words, we'd be interested here in looking at how, and sometimes why, agency is ascribed to states, under what conditions, in other words, we say that the state has acted. And I want to suggest, of course, there are different ways this can and has been done, and that there are different bases for ascribing agency to the state. In other words, then, state agency is not simply there or not there, something that you can in any simple way have or not have. It's a question of politics, of contestation, of claims and counterclaims, of arguments and counterarguments. It is a politics surrounding the ability, the attempt to fix a particular kind of a state agency, to ascribe agency in a particular kind of way. Second claim I want to make is that when we look again at IR theory, we find that there are three basic ways in which this has been done. and that, and this is my third claim, these correspond to a stylized, highly stylized in many respects, but nonetheless significant account of the process of state formation in the West. And finally, and again, I might not talk in huge detail about this, but when we turn to the African context, we find this picture of the possibilities of the ascription of agency to states embraced by Western states and Western agencies, and indeed in some circumstances by African politicians themselves. Now, just to sort of flag and reiterate, really, a couple of the conclusions. I don't think that the problem of state agency is unique for Africa, but I do think that the politics of agency is particularly acute there. And that agency is primarily a question of kind of politics, not a question of theory. Let me turn then to what I've called the problem of state agency in IR theory. I keep that section in the paper of a very famous quote from Kenneth Waltz. It seems to me worth repeating. In study, this is what he says in Man, State, and War. In studying international politics, it's convenient to think of states as the acting units. At the same time, it does violence to one's common sense to speak of the state, which is, after all, an abstraction and consequently inanimate, as acting. This is an important point for any theory of international relations. And Waltz, it seems to me, is one of the few IR theorists who even thought that the problem of state agency might be a serious problem. Generally, most scholars of international politics have been and continue to be happy to use the language of state agency all of the time. States do things. That's the kind of very stuff of a conversation about international politics. The problem of state agency is a problem, however, most notably because when scholars are pushed on exactly what they might mean when they say a state does things, they abandon the language of state agency and embrace more or less theoretical languages that deny the reality of this agency. And there's obviously several alternatives here. The foreign policy analysis tradition opens up the black box of the state and explores the agency of presidents and prime ministers and civil servants and bureaucrats or whatever it may be. More radically, there are those who argue that the state and its agency is reducible to individuals and their interactions, Demosthenes most famously. Others, from a sort of less consciously philosophical stance, have suggested that talk of state agency really refers to the actions of a few top policymakers or to individuals who act on behalf of the state. Gilpin famously said that the state does not really exist. E.H. Carr made the very puzzling claim that state agency is a necessary fiction. And there is, of course, the final possibility that Waltz, in at least some of his modes, embraces, which says that whether an assumption is useful, that is an assumption that states act is useful, depends on whether a theory based on the assumptions, based on that assumption, can be derived, you can derive a theory based on that assumption from which important consequences not otherwise obvious can be inferred. In other words, we don't worry about whether it's really true, we just look at our theory and say, well, does it kind of predict interesting things about the world? All these responses suggest that language of state agency is really a kind of shorthand. We don't really mean the state act, we just sort of use that as a quick and convenient shorthand to describe something else. Now, it might be suggested that this is fine, and when I've mooted this to people, they have suggested it's perfectly fine that we carry on like this. And the fact that most scholars of international relations are happy to inhabit this slightly schizophrenic analytical universe suggests that most of the time it is deemed relatively unproblematic within the discipline. But I'm not sure we can be entirely content with this. For a start, it's hard to know what to say to our students. I mean, either they do act or they don't. I mean, there must be something we can say to them when they ask us. Second, of course, to describe this as a shorthand begs the question of why we don't write in longhand. As a social science, we ought to say what we really mean at least a good portion of the time, even if it takes a little longer and is a little less elegant. And third, of course, the very discipline of IR is founded on the idea that it is meaningful to talk of states as acting, that there exists a realm within which states are the main actors, and that explaining the actions and interactions of these actors is the primary concern of the discipline. Realism, for example, would simply collapse into a discussion of the decisions of foreign policymakers, kind of political psychology, if it could only talk about individuals, as indeed Demosthenes comes comes very close to doing. Finally, though, and perhaps more important for the arguments of this paper, the slippery character of the problem. Sometimes we say states act, and then sometimes, no, it's the president, it's the prime minister, it's something else, it's not really that. Reveals, I think, and creates real political effects, which we ought to be aware of. In other words, the existence of these two kinds of conceptual language, both of which can be used, sometimes by the same academics, and certainly by the same kind of policymakers, allows a switching between them, based not on any very great philosophical insight, but based on a variety of political judgments. One only has to think of the treatment of kind of Gaddafi over the previous several months to realise this. It's perfectly sensible to say that he was representing the state, he signed treaties, did all kinds of things, totally unproblematic, and then several weeks later, no, he's not the government at all, and there's somebody else. But we've seen this also in Cote d'Ivoire and in lots of other countries. Now, part of the political character of ascriptions of agency to states is that, at least within IR, within IR theory, and I think beyond, such ascriptions can be composed of several different claims. Now, rather summarily, I'm going to just group them under three headings. The first one, which, and none of these, I mean, these are all fairly, I mean, we'll be familiar with most of them. The first revolves around collective identity. Here the argument is that some states, at least under some conditions, possess a kind of collective identity which allows us to say that when the state or the government acts, that action really is, in some senses, the action of the whole state. Waltz makes this claim in places. In Man, the State and War, he says that the centripetal force of nationalism may explain why states can be thought of as units. Even when nationalism is not so powerful, he suggests, it can still make sense to talk of states as acting units. There are times, he talks particularly about war, where states take on the character of a single acting unit, when the state mobilizes resources, interests, and sentiments. Second, he argues, following a kind of highly partial reading of Rousseau, that the idea of a unitary state works if the state is a unit that can, with some degree of appropriateness, take the adjective organismic. His word, not mine. So the first is a kind of idea about collective identity that either some states have it. This is essentially nationalism, but at least that's the obvious one that Waltz talks about. In other words, that really there is a common identity. People buy into the policies and practices of the state, and even when they don't individually, they're nonetheless carried along in these common projects, most emblematically, of course, war making. Wendt kind of also talks a little bit about this, where he talks about the importance of membership of a collective or an imagined community, which includes a discourse about the basic principles of their collective identity, what it is that binds people together, and collective memories that connect them to the state's members in the past. So that's a claim about collective identity as a basis for the description of state agency. A second and different, although obviously related, sense in which states can be thought to act is through the generation of collective action by the bureaucratic and coercive apparatuses of the state. As Wendt says, the institutionalization of collective action gives corporate agency the unity and persistence that it needs. And it's perfectly obvious, although I think worth stating, that the enormous number of things that modern states can do are all predicated on the existence of an extensive bureaucratic apparatus that transforms the actions and interactions of individuals into actions of an altogether different kind, collective actions in the pursuit of particular projects or policies. And it does this through the existence of structures and sets of rules that exist apart from the individuals that inhabit them, and provide the state with temporal continuity. Running alongside this bureaucratic apparatus of the state is a coercive apparatus that sometimes has the ability to generate action in the face of reluctance or disobedience. And it might also be something like this that's behind Waltz's rather brief remarks, which I mentioned earlier on, about how the particular anarchic and thus competitive structure of international politics selects certain kinds of institutional structures. And obviously this also connects up with the historical sociological accounts of state formation in Europe, where war fighting played a crucial role in driving the development of the modern bureaucratic state. there are all kinds of problems with that view, but that is another way we can think about state agency. Finally, and this is my third way we might think about it, there's a particular sense in which states can be said to act, which is through being represented. Certain persons are authorized to act on behalf of the state based on certain authorization rules, and whose actions, sayings and doings, are those importantly of the state. This is the sense, I think, in which those arguments to the effect that when we say a state acted, we really mean some top policymakers acted, should be understood. It's their position as policymakers, derived from certain rules about who and under what conditions someone can become a policymaker, that makes their actions those of the state, rather than just their individual actions. I can't declare war on another state, but the Prime Minister can. And when he does so, we are at war. And for Wendt, of course, the authorising effect of internal decision structures is the final constituent of corporate agency. And this authorisation means that individual actions are constituted as the actions of the collective. And of course, this also allows us to have arguments, about whether and when the actions of a person claiming to represent the state are to be understood as actually those of the state. If we think that these actions have in fact not been authorised by the appropriate authorisation rules, then we might be tempted to say, no, that's not, America did not sanction the Iran contract. That was just a few rogue agents who weren't following the rules. The basic problem here, how it is that one person or some persons can act on behalf of a collective, is a very old one. Hobbes, in particular, those who have got a historical interest in these things, worried about it extensively, because he needed an account of how individuals could represent the collective. Now, again, there are problems there, theoretically, but we can talk about those if you want. So there are these three ways in which states might be said to act. Now, of course, in all of these actions, it is, of course, important people who do things, but this does not imply that the actions of people can be rightly understood. But it does imply that the actions of individual people can be rightly understood as the actions of the state under some circumstances. Okay. Now, the great benefit, it seems to me, of sketching out these different ways in which states might be said to act is that they can, of course, relate to each other in a whole variety of different kinds of ways. In other words, this is that kind of field of possibility that provides the site for political contestation and, of course, empirical investigation, as well as very often normative judgments. For example, it might be the case that a state is characterised by a strong collective identity, but that the actions of a person claiming to represent that collective would not be seen as the actions of the state, simply because they had not been properly authorised. Similarly, we can imagine a situation in which the collective actions of the government might again not be seen as the state properly acting, as the government had not been authorised in the proper way or did not represent the collective identity of the people of the state, its African government under apartheid. We might also bear to imagine a situation in which a government was indeed recognised as the legitimate representative of the state, and thus their actions, those importantly of the state, but which struggled to achieve anything very much in the way of effective collective action. In these ways, then, it seems to me that we can see arguments about whether a state can be said to have acted might be intensely political arguments. They enable us to make all kinds of distinctions between the people, their identity, and the rulers, under which they have been authorised, between properly and improperly authorised representatives, between capabilities and legitimacy, all of which have very real political importance. And the politics of arguments about state agency can be seen in at least three other important ways. Firstly, there might be differences between the internal and external understandings of what constitutes legitimate representation. Or at least there might be external doubts about the legitimate representation of certain people or groups. In other words, people might think rather differently internally and externally about whether or not a particular government or a particular prime minister or president or is in fact the authorised representative of the state. Rulers or regimes may be deemed not to be legitimate, and thus their action is not the action of the state, even when they might have some capacity for collective action, and even when they might have most certainly created the belief that the state exists. Certainly we're saying that in Iran. It might work the other way, of course, as regimes or rulers are deemed to be legitimate representatives of the state by other states, and thus their actions are understood by other states as the actions of the state, even when internally they may not be understood in this way at all. Military governments after coups, perhaps many third world governments during the Cold War. Second, of course, it might be that there are changes over time in both the internal and external understandings of state agency. So, for example, it seems to me that collective national identity as the basis for legitimate descriptions of state agency is probably less important today than it was, and are more important, certainly more important to external actors, are particular authorization rules. Democracy, for example, as opposed to military coups, to what they'd be. And finally, of course, in recent years, as projects of state building have assumed significant importance in international politics, so the various ways in which states might legitimately be said to act has taken on a real practical political importance. As Western states and agencies have endeavoured to remake states in various ways that correspond to the ways in which we might think of states acting. So questions of identity have assumed considerable importance in the Balkans, for example, Kosovo, most obviously. The capacity of the state to engage in effective collective action has often been the target of considerable external attention. And, of course, Western states have tried to institute certain particular authorization rules, notably for democratic government. What I hope that sort of makes clear, or at least it doesn't make it terribly clear, but anyway, the point of all of that is to say, I think, that the philosophical and theoretical problem of state agency is only one part of the general problem of state agency. It's not to deny the importance of theory or philosophy. It is to say that beyond some basic questions, the really important matters are political and empirical ones. Okay, how much longer have I got?
No, I've got about 20 minutes.
Oh, okay, good. Slow down. Okay. The last bit of the paper turns to Africa and tries to say a little bit about this under these three headings. Now, you know, it's fairly sort of, I'm not sure I have anything particularly kind of dramatic to say, or at least anything that just, anything I'm going to say kind of spills out of what I've just been talking about. So given what I've already argued, the purpose is not to argue that African states can or cannot be said to act, but rather to look at the various ways in which arguments about state agency have been deployed in the African context, and to make the case that Western states and agencies are significantly concerned with the question of state agency on the continent. Now, there is, of course, by now a familiar, highly stylized, you know, possibly false in lots of ways, story about the entrance into international politics of the newly independent African states, following Jackson, Clapham and others. Many of the traditional demands of statehood were abandoned, while at the same time international society treated these states as proper states with some of the rights and obligations that attended this. Diplomatic recognition, seats in the United Nations, the rights of non-intervention, and so on. And in addition to this negative sovereignty regime, international society took upon itself to assist these new states in their projects of state building and international development. Nonetheless, right from the beginning, newly independent states in Africa struggled to make themselves into states that might properly be thought of as acting. And over time, Western states and agencies took an increasing interest in the conditions of African agency. In other words, the politics of agency played a central role in the internal and international politics of many newly independent African states. Let me talk briefly then about collective identity, about the sort of generation of collective action, and finally about questions of representation and authorization. Having assumed power and taken over the colonial state apparatus, many newly independent African leaders forthrightly embraced the language of nationhood, and as we sort of mentioned earlier on, that has not gone away. Dear listener, Ari speaking in 1955 was typically forthright. Another objective is to build up a national consciousness among the African people in Tanganyika. It has been said, and this is quite right, that Tanganyika is a tribal, and we realise we need to break up this tribal consciousness among the people and to build a national consciousness. That is one of our objectives towards self-government. And of course, it was precisely the recognition that the people of most African states rarely constituted a nation that animated the project of nation building, an attempt to generate a sense of national identity and attachment to the state that would supersede the particular forms of identity that existed. And of course, this problem was particularly pressing because the ideas of collective identity were so important in the constitution of the state and its agency. It was not just that the people residing within the territory of many African states manifestly did not share any extensive collective identity. It was that claims to the effect that states should be characterized by a collective identity threatened the territorial integrity of many African states whose borders crossed groups that might have constituted more plausible claims to a collective identity. The project of nation building took different forms, of course, but it was manifest, for example, in education and cultural policy. Perhaps most obviously, it was also shaped by particular kinds of economic strategy pursued in many African states, where creating the idea of the state, famous phrase, in the everyday life of African people was at least one of the drivers for the significant expansion of state intervention in the economy. Although it also shaped, although of course did not determine, the elision between nation, party, father of the nation, characterized some African states through the 1960s. There were, however, always, of course, ambiguities and tensions. First, and this talks to some of the things that Stefan was talking about earlier on, it's clear that the capacity of the state to impose itself in an effective way upon diverse societies was limited, in some cases radically so, and declined as the economic crisis engulfed the continent. Second, the discourse of national identity was, of course, extremely complex and still is. There are difficult questions about the relationship to the colonial experience, to do with how much of the language, culture, and conceptual apparatus of the metropole to embrace, and to do with the relationship between nationalism and pan-Africanism. Despite this, the project of nation building was at least in principle, and I think in practice, endorsed by Western states and agencies, even if they had anxieties about the content of certain ideological programs. And of course, this was in some large part precisely to do with conceptual apparatus of modernity and a picture of what a modern state and its agency should look like, and to do with the links that modernization theorists had made between the nation and the ability of the state to lead a grand project of national development. Now, as economic and political crisis kind of engulfed the continent during the late 1970s and 1980s, so we would talk of nation building, and certainly amongst Western agencies and Western states, there are a great deal more skepticism about the possibilities of nation building in on the continent, not about its desirability necessarily, but about what that actually was a cover for, the pursuit of elite interests in various kinds of ways, corruption and a whole set of other things. Now, I still want to say that, I won't talk about this, but I still think there are elements of this in contemporary Western practice, which suggest that the idea that some kind of national identity remains a part of the ways in which Western states and agencies think about states, particularly in discussions of civil society and questions of identity within civil society. Nonetheless, it does seem to me clear anyway that the project of nation building, the idea in other words of generating a collective identity that can ground claims about state agency, is much less prominent now than it was in the past, and is certainly a much less prominent part of the discourse surrounding African states. I think there are probably reasons for that beyond the economic crisis, but anyway. Let me turn to collective action. The problems that African states have had in generating effective collective action are well known. And indeed, right from the beginning of the study of the post-colonial African politics, the ability of the state to govern effectively, to generate effective collective action through the bureaucratic and coercive apparatus of the state has been questioned. And the effectiveness of the African state has been compromised, at least in the eyes of Western states, and many Western commentators, by a number factors, so-called neo-patrimonialism, corruption, poverty, political instability, economic and fiscal crisis, and so on. And of course, in some ways, this is seen as a problem by many Western states and agencies, not just because it's led to economic crisis, but because the grandest of grand projects, development, requires a state capable of acting in effective collective ways. And the problem with the capabilities of the African state, its ability to generate effective collective action, is one that dominated the actions of Western states and development agencies right from the 1980s in the structural adjustment, although it accelerated in the 1990s with the ideas of good governance and various programs for reform of the state. This is included amongst very many other things, procedures around government budgeting, tax collection, the construction of new information systems, reducing corruption, reducing the personalised count of African bureaucracies, and so on and so forth. It's involved all kinds of training and capacity building programs for African politicians and bureaucrats. And all this activity, at least in some significant part, is about making African states act in ways that modern states are thought to act, through rational bureaucratic procedures that generate effective collective action in the pursuit of certain goals. Now, and just to turn to the third, in ways that reflect the very idealised history of Western states. So this kind of attempt to generate more effective and capable government has been accompanied by an anxiety about how any such effective and capable state might relate to its society. The representatives of newly independent African states were generally recognised by international society as having the ability to act on behalf of their states. They signed contracts, they signed treaties, they entered into all kinds of agreements with all kinds of other states. Indeed, for some years after independence, the internal structures and decision-making procedures in African states were generally, not always, insulated from international scrutiny. Even rulers whose authority to rule was deemed, at least deemed by the rulers themselves, to derive from God, such as Emperor Haile Selassie, were not deemed to be illegitimate representatives of their states, despite the fact that these kinds of claims were deeply anachronistic to most Western states. The negative sovereignty regime accepted African rulers and representatives of African states as the legitimate representatives of these states and accepted their actions as the actions of these states. There was, of course, a dark side to this too. One partial exception to this, of course, were the regimes in Rhodesia, Namibia, and South Africa. And here the anxiety about these governments was twofold. These governments could not plausibly be said to represent the collective identity of their states. And their claims to be representatives of their states were questioned as the basis of their authority was deemed to have violated international norms. Of course, for a large period, part of the post-war period, these governments were accepted as governments by Western states, and their ambassadors and presidents were accorded international recognition, at least some of the time. But it was also increasingly accepted that these governments were, in some important respects, illegitimate, and that they could not plausibly claim to act on behalf of their states, even when, as in the South African case, they did have the capacity for effective collective action. And in more recent times, of course, Western states and agencies become more and more concerned with the authorising rules within all African states that would generate legitimate claims to represent that state. Democracy promotion, obviously, but also can be seen in such initiatives as HIPIC, Debt Relief, and the NetBand process. And there have also been actions taken against regimes that somehow or another are thought not to be properly representative, Zimbabwe, for example. And even some of the more respected and supportive regimes have experienced pressures to engage in democratic transitions, Ghana and Uganda, for example. In this way, Western states and agencies have demonstrated a very significant concern with the authorization rules that would enable representatives to be legitimately understood as acting for the state. Right, let me just make a couple of points by way of conclusion. It seems to me, at least, it does seem to me that the discourses and practices of Western states and development agencies have been heavily shaped by the more general and abstract arguments over what constitutes state agency. They are working with a perfectly clear, at least it's clear to me, even if they don't make it terribly clear, account of what makes a state act. Whether this account is entirely consistent is another matter, and clearly it's heavily informed by a rather idealised account of Western states and their trajectory. Collective identity, collective action, and legitimate representation are all thought to go together in this classic kind of Western story, or at least there is a story about how they build upon each other to come to some end point where all three exist, some form of collective identity, effective collective action, and some form of democratic authorization rules. Whether they really, all three of them, can and do go together in African states, it seems to me, is another question. All right, final concluding points. I think there are several possible implications for what I've been trying to say. First, that the question of state agency is most emphatically not an esoteric and philosophical one, about which scholars of international relations and the African politics can be relatively unconcerned. As I've tried to show, or at least as I think I could try to show, it matters politically and empirically a very great deal how and under what conditions states might be said to act. Secondly, different kinds of ways in which states might be said to act are in the world, in the arguments that people have about whether this or that person is a legitimate representative of the government, whether this action or that action can legitimately be understood as that of the state as opposed to some other thing. In other words, sometimes rather incoherent recognition of the problems and possibilities of state agents that we find in IR theory are replicated in the actions of Western states and agencies, and indeed in the actions and strategies of African politicians. And in both of these cases, they're informed by a particular account of what makes a proper state that is derived from the historical trajectory of Western states. Third, there is no final resolution. I'll perhaps be slightly wary of making this, but I'm saying it anyway. There is no final resolution to the question of state agency in any particular case. In that sense, it's all politics. And this applies to all states, I think, not just African states, although the issues raised in African ones are particularly acute. We can think of the Not In My Name protests about the war in Iraq, for example, or indeed, most obviously, Iran-Contra. What these debates are about is precisely what kind of actions can be legitimately described as the state acting. Stop there.
Thank you very much, then.